Chapter 11. Night. The flat she rents is dark. It's on the ground floor of the apartment complex. The darkness is because the living room faces a dense wooded area. She'd rented it because she liked having a view of the tall tree's lower trunks. She hadn't considered that the woods would leave the living room in shadow, even in the daytime. Back when her son still lived with her, they'd kept the triphosphor fluorescent lamps on all day, as these were said to be closer to sunlight, but now she cannot feel the need. She spends the majority of her time in the darkened living room, where it is impossible to gauge the weather outside. She almost never goes into the bedroom, with its double bed, wardrobe, and television that she used to share with her son. It's the same with a small room with a raw timber desk and bookcase she'd had custom made for him. That room is the sole bright spot in her house, where the tree's shadows do not fall, but the door stays closed except on the days when the child is visiting. Directly after her mother's funeral, when she and her son were still together, when she was still speaking, she pulled out clothes to wear for her year of mourning and hung them on a 60-centimeter wide clothes rack. A black cotton spring and autumn shirt and a black short-sleeved blouse, one pair of black cotton trousers and one pair of black jeans, a black turtleneck sweater and a long black woolen coat, a thickly knitted black muffler and a pair of dark gray gloves. "There. I won't have to buy anything else," she muttered to herself, standing in front of the rack, and her son, who had been perched on the bed watching what she was doing, asked,
"Why do you have to wear only black for a whole year?"
She replied calmly, "So as not to be cheerful, I guess."
"Are you not allowed to be cheerful?"
"I'd feel bad."
"For Grandma? But Grandma would want you to be happy, Mom."
Only then did she look back at her son and smile. Her lifestyle is simple. She launders her few black outfits without delay, shops for the minimum of groceries at the nearby store, prepares the minimum of food and, after eating, promptly tidies everything away. In the daytime hours, when she is not occupied with those basic tasks, she generally sits unmoving on the living room sofa, looking out at the tall trees' verdant branches and thick lower trunks. The house grows dark when it is still not yet evening. Around the time when the tree's contours grow black, she opens the front door and goes out. She passes through the apartment complex as dusk is falling, reaches the pedestrian crossing where the green light doesn't stay on for long, and carries on walking. She walks in order to exhaust herself to the point of no longer being able to walk. She walks until she is unable to register the quiet of the house, to which she must now return, until she has no strength left to cast her gaze over the black woods, the black curtains, the black sofa, the black Lego boxes. She walks until, giddy with tiredness, she will be able to lie down on her side on the sofa and fall asleep without washing or tugging a quilt over herself. She walks so that she will not wake in the middle of the night, even if plagued by nightmares, so that she will not toss and turn with her eyes open until dawn, unable to achieve sleep again. She walks so that, in those vivid dawn hours, she will not have to doggedly recall and piece together the broken shards of memories. On Thursdays, when there is a Greek class, she packs her bag a little earlier than she needs to. After alighting from the bus several stops before the academy, she walks, enduring the afternoon heat radiating from the tarmac. Even after she slips into the building's shadowed interior, her whole body is drenched in sweat for a while. Once, she had just gone up to the first floor when she saw the Greek lecturer walking ahead of her. She stopped in her tracks instinctively. She held her breath so as not to make a sound. Having already sensed someone's presence, he turned to look back over his shoulder and smiled. It was a smile that mingled closeness, awkwardness, and resignation. and made it clear that he had been about to greet her, then brought himself up short. Now it faded into an earnest expression, as if he were formally asking her to excuse his initial familiarity. After that day, when she happened to bump into him on the stairs or in the corridor, he did not smile, but greeted her faintly with his eyes. Up until the moment they entered the empty classroom, one through the rear door and one through the front, they walked with a similar stride, with their upper bodies leaning forward at a similar angle and their bags slung over their shoulders, calmly aware of each other's presence. There is a particular expression his face assumes when he addresses someone. His gaze humbly requests the other person's consent. There are occasionally times when something other than deference, something like an inexplicable, delicate sadness, haunts his look. It was around 30 minutes before the lesson start, and they were the only ones in the classroom. After taking her seat, she got out her textbook and writing things from her bag, one by one, distractedly raised her head, and their eyes met. He stood up from his own chair, which was placed next to the lectern, and approached a desk that was at a little distance from hers. After pulling out the chair and making space, he sat down facing the aisle. He raised both hands and lightly interlaced them in the air. It was just for a few moments, but she thought he was asking for a handshake. He was quiet for a while with his hands interlaced like that, as though he were making up his mind whether or not to address her and would let her know in due course. Not long afterward, there was the sound of footsteps in the corridor, and he stood up and went back to his place next to the lectern. There are times when they look at each other without speaking, waiting for the lesson to begin. After the lesson has begun, in the corridor, during breaks, in front of the office. Little by little, his face became familiar to her. His once unremarkable features, expressions, frame, and postures became distinctive. But she did not assign any meaning to this, having never thought about the change in words. It is a sweltering July night. The two fans set up on either side of the blackboard are rotating with fierce intensity. The windows on either side of the classroom are flung wide open.
"This world is ephemeral and beautiful, is it not?" he says. "But rather than this ephemeral and beautiful world, Plato wanted one that was eternal and beautiful."
The postgrad, who had been almost over-earnest in every lesson so far, has been nodding off for the last 20 minutes. The man behind the pillar, after repeatedly wiping the nape of his neck with a handkerchief, has fallen asleep with his forehead on his desk, as though finally succumbing to exhaustion. Only she and the philosophy student are awake. When the breeze from the oscillating fan pulls away from him, the youth instantly starts fluttering a long fan made of hanji to cool his sweat.
"The Republic is actually a dynamic text. It draws the reader in through the energetic progression of its reasoning alone. Now and then, in the development of an argument, at the narrow and dangerous passages, well, to speak metaphorically, every time he steps to the edge of the cliff, Plato borrows Socrates' voice to ask the reader, 'Are you following me?' As a reckless leader of a climbing party looks back over his shoulder to check on the others. He knows that this is a dangerous soliloquy, that he is, in fact, answering his own question, as do we who are reading."
With his placid gaze behind the pale green lenses, he looks directly at her clear eyes. Perhaps because the students are especially unfocused today, for close on 10 minutes he has been explaining the context of the text rather than its grammar. At some point, the nature of these reading classes has come loosely to straddle Greek language and philosophy.
"People who, though they believe in beautiful objects, do not believe in beauty itself. Plato deemed such people to be in a state of dreaming, and was convinced that one could be persuaded that this was the case through reasoning. In his world, everything was upside down like this. That is to say, he considered that he himself was awake and not dreaming. He who, rather than trusting in the beautiful objects of reality, trusted only in an absolute beauty that cannot exist in reality. Passing in front of the office with her bag slung over her shoulder after the class was over, she sees him talking to the part-time admin with Bob Tear. The young woman is engrossed in explaining the features of her new smartphone. Bending forward at the waist, he has his face practically pressed up against the phone, and it appears as though his glasses are about to collide with it. The posture makes him look more diminutive than he is. The woman speaks rapidly in a high-pitched voice.
See? This is a real-time webcam broadcast from a colony of penguins at the South Pole. It cools me down when the heat's unbearable. Looks like it's night there, too. Here, do you see them? The penguins are already all asleep. What, this? The dark purplish bit? I told you, that's the sea. The whitish bit is ice. It's all glaciers. Wow, it's just started snowing. See? The shining specks here? Can't you see?
Slipping out of the main door of the faded Academy building, she sees the postgrad standing by the dark wall, on the phone to someone. An unlit cigarette held between his fingers, he speaks in a low whisper, not realizing that she is passing by, and says, through clenched teeth,
I told you I won't ask you for help. Just don't stand in my way. It's the money I need to study abroad. The money I've worked my fingers to the bone to save up. The reason I don't yet have a master's at my age. You'll be ruined whether or not I give you every one of it, won't you, Father? Ruined. And ruined again. And again forever.
When the Greek lesson is over, she walks the dark streets as she has always done. The vehicles on the road speed past daringly, as they always do. Motorbikes carrying midnight snacks in red metal boxes weave in and out of the traffic, ignoring both lanes and lights. Past drunks young or old, weary workers in skirt suits or short-sleeved shirts, elderly women staring blankly from the entrances of empty restaurants, she carries on walking. She arrives at the bustling intersection of an 8-lane and a 4-lane road. Buildings soar up in the distance, enormous digital billboards blazing from their tops. As always, she stops in front of the pedestrian crossing and looks up at those screens. Faces larger than life move enormous lips to speak inaudible words. Giant letters flow along the bottoms of the screens, twitching their mouths like fish. Giant magnified news screens flash past. Corpses on stretchers, crowds, a flaming airplane, wailing women. Before she knows it, the light goes green. Crossing the black tarmac from which the radiant heat has not yet cooled, she walks toward the street opposite. The LED signs go on mutely, emitting their stream of giant images and letters. A sleek car racing silently across a vast desert. An actress in a low-cut dress, laughing soundlessly, flicker like ghosts above the black street. By the time she arrives at the huge river that cuts across the city, her dusty face is gleaming with sweat. She continues along the walkway of the riverside path, which seems to stretch on forever. The lights reflected in the dark river bob up and down. She has knots in her calves, and the soles of her feet in her thin sandals feel on fire. The humid black wind rising off the surface of the water slowly cools her body. She cannot know that, afloat in the air she has breathed in every night since last spring, were infinitesimal luminous bodies, which have inadvertently entered her respiratory system and are still twinkling there. She cannot know the elements that, faintly brightening the interstices of her cells, are transparently passing through and drifting within. Xenon and cesium, 137. Radioactive iodine, 131. Which has a short half-life and will soon disappear. She is ignorant of the particles of stodgy red blood that are flowing unrelentingly through her veins. She is ignorant of her black lungs and muscles and viscera, of the hot heart powerfully pumping.
She enters the underpass and carries on walking. She walks past shops with their shutters already down, past those where the lights are just being switched off. She passes a pair of near-senseless drunks, engaged in a hopeless fight outside a public toilet. After reaching the end of the underpass, elongated like an alimentary canal, she is disgorged onto the dark streets. She makes her way over a dangerous crossing whose traffic lights aren't working, where an orange signal light is blinking. She passes along a road that is like a ruin, with no one about, where dozens of cars huddle soundlessly in a black public car park. She passes through the bleak downtown area again. She passes noisy down-at-heel bars. She passes drunks, walking out into the middle of the road, risking their necks to hail a taxi. She passes lewd looks that shamelessly meet her gaze and the unfocused pupils of indifferent eyes. When midnight is near, she discovers that she has arrived at the entrance to an unfamiliar cinema. The lights are off in the booth. All the tickets for the final film have been sold. Without realizing what she is doing, she approaches the booth's translucent acrylic partition. She brings her lips close to its 8 black holes, then flinches away. As if a terrifying force might blast out of those neat, orderly holes and forcibly aspirate her voice from her lips and throat. The bus stop in front of the theater is dark and dirty. She stands among crumpled beer cans, empty fizzy drink bottles, plastic bags, someone spit, scattered bits of trampled popcorn. She is done with walking now. She sees a bus approaching that might be the last one of the night. It doesn't go by her house, but it will take her to the area. The moment she steps up onto the bus, she is startled by the incredibly strong air conditioning. Inside, in the dim light, around a dozen passengers sit in silence. It is a silence thick with fatigue, a sense of defeat, and something like hostility worn faint over time. She walks down the aisle to where there is an empty double seat. A late-night drama flows out from the muted television installed behind the driver's seat. A man and a woman are quarreling soundlessly. Then they break off and bring their lips together in a fierce, long embrace. The color setting is wrong, and the screen has a blue tinge. She doesn't look at the television screen. Terrible fatigue rushes in on her, and yet, though she shuts her eyes, sleep evades her. She has goosebumps on her arms and the back of her neck from the aggressive air conditioning. She looks out of the window. The bus is cutting through the streets of the city, which is lit up all night. Muffins and slices of cake in various colors are displayed in the clear glass fridges of dazzlingly illuminated cafes. A fake diamond necklace glitters in the display case of a jewelry shop closed for the night. On an enormous poster, covering one side of a building, a familiar male actor is laughing, crinkling the fine wrinkles around his eyes. A woman in a short dress and unseasonal leather boots raises the hand clutching her mobile to hail a taxi. On the stairs in front of a shuttered Bunsik bar, a man with gray-streaked hair is lying huddled on some newspaper. She remembers the kaleidoscope she made at primary school. She joined 3 rectangular pieces of a mirror, which she'd had cut in a mirror shop, to make a triangular prism, then scissored colored paper into tiny pieces and put them inside. She was instantly captivated by the strange world that unfolded inside each time she held one end up to her eye and shook the kaleidoscope. After losing words, there were times when that world rose up in front of her eyes, overlaying whatever scene was already there. When, exhausted as she was now, a bus bore her through the night street's solid black forest. When walking up the dark, narrow stairs of the academy building. When passing down the long corridor that led to the classroom. When gazing at afternoon sunlight, quiet and trees, leaves, the patterns of yellow light between them. When walking beneath the neon signs and colored bulbs that flashed noisily, as if fit to burst. Once she lost words, all such scenery became fragmented, each piece distinct and separate, like the colored paper inside the kaleidoscope, shifting silently, repeatedly, and in concert to form new patterns. Her son was six. For once, it was a leisurely Sunday morning, and, after an aimless conversation, she suggested to him that they come up with names for themselves, based on what natural thing they most resembled. Her son liked the idea, claimed Sparkling Forest for himself, then named her too, decisively, as though it fitted her exactly.
Thickly Falling Snow Sorrow.
What?
That's your name, Mum.
Not knowing what to say, she peered into his clear eyes. The shards of memories shift and form patterns. Without particular context, without overall perspective or meaning, they scatter. Suddenly, decisively, they come together. Like innumerable butterflies, stilling the movement of their wings as one. Like unfeeling dancers who obscure their faces. The outer ring road of Gwangju, where she spent her childhood, appears to her in that way. As does the summer when she was nine. The national holiday afternoon when she crossed the road near the house, walking behind the white dog she had raised for almost 5 years. A car going faster than the limit struck the dog like a bolt of lightning and screamed away. A hit and run. The lower part of the dog's torso was stuck fast to the warm tarmac that had been laid only a few days before, flat as a sheet of paper. With only its front legs, chest, and head still in solid, three-dimensional form, the dog groaned, foaming at the mouth. She raced over heedlessly and tried to embrace the dog. The dog, using all its strength, sank its teeth into her shoulder, her chest. She couldn't even scream. She tried to block the dog's mouth with her arms. The moment it bit her wrist for the second time, she fainted, and by the time the grown-ups had come running over, the dog was dead. The flooded rice paddies that gleamed in all directions, in every place her gaze touched, appear in that way. It was the spring when she was 20. That long day when the body of her dead father had been transported from the night duty guardroom where he'd worked to their family burial ground on the outskirts of Gwangju. As if the whole world had been turned into a fish tank, the glittering paddy fields stretched out as far as the eye could see, brimming with dazzling deep blue water. The strange dream in which her lips swell up blackish red appears in that way. In that recurring dream, she sees blood and pus flow from the place where a blister has burst. She watches her front tooth shudder at the root, as though eager to shake itself loose. And when she spits out saliva, she sees that it comes mixed with a mouthful of blood. She sees a hand, she cannot tell whose, plug her mouth fast with sterile cotton rolls that are as firm as pebbles. Decisively, as though wanting to stop her both blood and screams. After alighting from the bus, she resumes walking. She walks without rest, the distance of 5 or 6 bus stops, at one point turning into a one-way street where fragments of concrete that had once formed the pavement lie broken. Because the bus's air conditioning had been too strong, the sweltering night still feels pleasantly warm. Pushing aside the grass that has straggled up through each crack in the concrete, she walks. Between the black leather straps of her sandals, moisture beads her bare skin. Makes no judgments, ascribes no emotions. Everything appears as fragments, scatters as fragments, disappears. Words grow a little more distant from the body. Emotions that had saturated them, like heavy layers of shadow, like stench and nausea, like something viscous, fall away. Like tiles that, long underwater, have lost their adhesiveness. Like a part of one's flesh that has rotted without one's knowing. Having had sweat soak it, then dry on it, repeatedly from morning until night. Her clammy body is now reflected in the mirror that hangs above the sink. She steps into the bathtub, which is half full of warm water. Curls her dust-covered body into the most comfortable position. She drifts into sleep without realizing it, and only when the water is almost stone cold does she shiver and start awake. She carefully touches her lips to her sleeping child's eyelids. She lies down beside him and closes her eyes. If she opens her eyes, it seems she will see the thickly falling snow, so she closes them even more tightly. With her eyes closed, none of it is visible. Neither the big glittering hexagonal crystals, nor the flakes soft as feathers. Neither the deep purple sea, nor the glacier like a white mountain peak. There are neither words nor color for her until the night is over. Everything is covered by the thick snow. A snow that is like time. Time that fractured as it froze, settles ceaselessly over her stiff body. The child by her side isn't there. Lying motionless at the bed's chilly edge, she calls the dream into being, over and over again, to kiss her son's warm eyelids.
Chapter 12. The postgrad raises his fleshy hand and asks the Greek lecturer a question. His earnest, resonant voice rings out in the quiet classroom. His sweat-soaked gray-striped t-shirt clings to his back and armpits, making a pattern of darker gray.
"I'm wondering about the difference between the divine, dothaimonian, two-daimonian, and the sacred, dothaion, two-theon. In the previous class, you said that theoria, theoria, also means to look. Is the sacred tithaeon also related to the verb to look? And in that case, are the gods perhaps beings that look, or the look itself?"
Now the philosophy student sitting next to her asks a question. He has a slight Tegu accent. The lock screen of the mobile phone that he has just set down is a photo of him with a short-haired girl in a white t-shirt, the two of them holding up their arms to make a big heart shape.
"In the part that argues everything has within it that which harms it, he uses the example of how the inflammation of the eye ruins the eye and blinds it, and how rust ruins iron and completely shatters it. Why then, isn't the human soul, which is analogous to such things, ruined by its foolish bad attributes?"
Chapter 13. The sun was not yet up. Someone came into my room, touched my shoulder, and handed me a letter. After rubbing my eyes, getting up and thanking them, I ripped open the envelope, which was completely blank, to find a single sheet of snow-white paper, neatly folded twice. Unfolding it, I could tell by the feel of the paper that the letter was written in Braille. I began cautiously to grope my way through the sentences, line by line, until I had reached the end. I understood nothing. I couldn't even tell whether it was written in Korean Braille or in another Braille alphabet. Only then did it occur to me that I had never learned Braille. I placed this anonymous, unfathomable letter on my knee. I may have trembled a little. What response should I now give to the messenger? I couldn't recall the face of the person who had handed me the letter and remained standing by my pillow. I looked up, and as I did so, I thought I'd woken from a dream about the letter, but I was still dreaming. There was no one in the room. As though one of the mornings of my childhood had come back to me, every object entered my field of vision with clear color and form. The window was open. The deep blue curtain shook a little, as if there were a breeze. The air in the room shimmered distinctly, as though it contained minute orbs of glass. I saw that countless droplets of water were beating on the pale blue paint of the wall. Seeing the glimmering droplets that had seeped in from the wall's outer surface, I wondered, is it raining outside? Why is it so bright? The moment I realize I have been sleeping, that I have only dreamed that my eyes were open, I feel no agony. I feel no sense of loss or resignation. As sleep slowly dissipates from my body, I simply turn away from the dream. Simply gaze at the indistinct ceiling, my eyes finally open, and at the collapsed contours of the objects around me. Simply confirm that there is no outside world that I can once more escape to from this dream. Chapter 14, Faces. It still doesn't seem real. You, Joachim Grindel, dying at 38 years of age. Like that unfamiliar dream in which I ran my fingertips over every Braille letter and then felt compelled to say I had somehow understood. I know you aren't able to come from so far away, your mother told me. The funeral would be starting in 6 hours. She deliberately informed me late to ease my mind. I apologized as calmly as I could. She replied that it was all right and asked if I was getting on okay. I said that I was, and that I would pay her a visit when I returned to Germany. Your mother didn't answer straight away. After a brief silence, she said in a thick voice, "Of course. You are always welcome." From the Saturday morning when I received that phone call, I've been lying in this bed and looking up at the ceiling. Every time hunger drove me to open the door of the fridge, I was surprised by the distinct outlines of the items inside in that strong illumination. That cold, clearly delineated space seemed a frozen paradise to me, and I lingered with the door open, dragging out the time. Pulling out something simple to eat, I'd sit at the dining table and briefly appease my hunger, then go back and lie down like a patient on bed rest. The window in your room was unusually large and bright. On afternoons, when the room got a lot of light, each of the dozens of model airplanes displayed on the shelf below the window frame gave off a sleek light. While I stood there, with my back to you, exclaiming at the exquisite detail of the airplanes, you sat cross-legged on the bed with its blue and green checked sheets and carried on talking. Whenever I turned my head and met your gaze, you playfully wrinkled your nose to shift the horn-rimmed glasses up its bridge. Your brilliantly wide-ranging and freewheeling conversation traversed various topics at length, passing through tunnels and winding routes of allusions and quotes and logical arguments, as befitted someone so well-read. When your words felt drawn out, I would sneak a bite of the wonderful pie your mother had baked, and, inconspicuously but closely, look over the photocopies of old maps on the blue-tinged plaster wall next to the desk. The photographs of planets, the black-and-white miniature drawings of an armadillo, a mammoth, a Neanderthal in profile. Now and then, and without great tact or care, you took up the topic of my eyes and segued into the inseparable issue of my future. This, despite the fact that you were not oblivious of how this privately injured me. You spoke cheerfully. If I were you, I'd learn Braille ahead of time to be prepared, and get used to walking around outside on my own with a white cane. I'd get a wonderful, well-trained retriever and live with it until it died of old age. In a way, you believed that you had the right to speak to me in this manner, that you'd experienced enough suffering yourself to talk unreservedly about whatever misfortunes the world had to offer. You'd had dozens of operations, major and minor, since you were a newborn. And apparently when you were 14, you were told you had only 6 months left to live. You said that all the doctors and nurses were astounded to see you enter university after a period of dogged self-study. You said that I was the first friend you'd made since coming out of hospital. I remember, distinctly, your gaunt body, which had shocked me the first time we met. Your forehead, as deeply wrinkled as that of a middle-aged man, though you had been born just 7 months ahead of me. You frowned, furrowing those wrinkles even more deeply, and said, I have to say, if I ever put out a book in my name, I want there to be a Braille edition. I want someone to glide their hand over each letter and each line of the book. That would be, I guess, real connection. A way for us to really touch, don't you think? You turned your face fully toward mine, as if to show that this was not a throwaway comment. I remember your expression, the intent self-awareness of the highly sensitive, legible in your face. And those faint blue eyes, your irises clearly visible in the sunlight. I could tell that you wanted to touch my face then, or for me to touch yours. But I promptly pushed the thought away. Every so often, I think of that Sunday when we climbed the nearby mountain for the first and last time, scrambling over the pale, articular rocks in shorts, taking care not to scratch my calves on the sharp leaves that sprouted from scraggy shrubs, going further up with my palms on my knees for support, resting and wiping away the sweat, guzzling some of the water we'd frozen the night before, munching the black bread we'd wrapped up as a snack, exchanging jokes I can't recall now, and idle, pointless laughter. Then, seeing the sun begin to set when we still hadn't reached the top, we made our way back down. The village where I spent my childhood had rocky mountains like this one, I confided to you then. I told you I came of age looking up at two white peaks called Insbong and Pekunde. That, even to that day, when I thought of my motherland, rather than the bustling city with its population of 10 million, I thought of those peaks, which were like a pair of faces. I recall my words because, rather than responding in your usual jesting and garrulous way, you suffered a fall. You tumbled 2 or 3 meters down the sloping path until a tallish rock brought you up short. I couldn't believe what was happening. You'd told me that you were completely better now, that you were done reliving the tedious fight with disease that had worn on for 20 years. You'd brandished your cigarettes and defiantly downed glass after glass of beer. I hadn't doubted those words, full of self-confidence, in the slightest. I remember your stiff face, which looked like that of a stranger. I remember my hands shaking out of fear, the fear of witnessing someone's death for the first time. I remember your closed eyelids, silent and unmoving. I remember descending that steep, rocky path with you on my back, my underwear drenched from exertion, pepper-sharp sweat trickling steadily inside my eyelids. 10 days after that descent, you raised your upper body aslant in the hospital's metal bed and said, "You once asked me why I wanted to do philosophy, right? You really want to hear what I think?" Your glasses were on the bedside table where you'd left them, but you wrinkled your nose all the same. "You know how they say that, to the ancient Greeks, virtue wasn't goodness or nobility, but the ability to do a certain thing in the very best way. Arete was their word. The capacity for excellence. Well, think about it. Who would be best able to think about life? Someone who faces death at every turn. Someone who, for that reason, is inevitably thinking of death always, necessarily, urgently. And wouldn't that effectively mean someone like me possesses the finest arete, at least for contemplation?" This happened on a day many years later, after I'd left you and was traveling alone in Switzerland. I took a boat from Lucerne Harbor and floated through the ice-covered valleys for hours. My initial plan had been to stay on the boat all the way to its final destination, the deepest part of the lake. But I abruptly disembarked at a small city called Bronnen when I saw the two large, white, rocky peaks flanking the harbor. To my eyes, the left-hand peak resembled Pekunde, and the right resembled Insbong. Seen from Suyuri, the neighborhood where I grew up, Pekunde rises to the left of Pukansan, and Insbong to the right. In reality, Pekunde is higher, but Insbong looks higher because it stands a little in front. The relative location and slight difference in height between Brunnen's two peaks, even the features of the white rocks and the density of the forests, were reminders of that childhood landscape. Unprepared as I had been to encounter such a familiar sight, I think it came as something of a shock. As soon as I disembarked at the quay, a young man, sitting on an aluminum folding chair in front of the cafe, caught my eye. Pale blonde hair and a pleasantly oval face. Baggy dungarees. He didn't resemble you in the slightest, yet he made me think of you. "What are you eating? Is it good?" I asked him as he smiled at me.
"Yeah, it's Swiss cheesecake, since it's Friday," he answered, sticking his thumb up.
I went into the cafe and ordered the same cake, then went outside and sat at the table next to his. When I asked, "But what's Friday got to do with cheesecake?" he answered,
"On Fridays, everyone eats cheesecake instead of meat. Not that I'm a deeply religious person or anything. It's because Jesus died on a Friday."
The conversation that passed between us was pretty routine. We asked each other where we were born, what we did, what the city was like, where I planned to travel next. I learned that his name was Emmanuel, and he was an electrician, that he found his job monotonous, that he wanted to travel to Germany and Austria someday, that he'd lived with his mother for 10 years after his parents got divorced when he was 3, then with his father for the next 10 years. He discovered that I was in my second year of brain-aching study in Konstanz, which bordered Switzerland, that Bodensee was indeed as beautiful as Lake Lucerne, but gloomy in winter, as the surrounding towns were constantly shrouded in fog. And that on days when the fog didn't lift until the evening, your range of vision was so limited that you had to have your shoulder right up against the outer walls of the buildings as you walked along. He seemed somewhat disappointed by the fact that I had never been to Berlin. I had no desire to look around the small, ordinary town of Bronnen. I was content to sit next to Emmanuel and look out at the lake, and to share aimless chat as I ate the cheesecake, which was not at all sweet. The sunlight was dazzling, but the wind off the water was quite sharp. Around half an hour later, the returning boat pulled in, and I parted from Emmanuel with a light handshake. We exchanged only names, not email addresses or anything like that. I waved at him as the boat pulled out of the dock, and he waved back at me. The aluminum chair on which I had been sitting, the plate of cheesecake I had left unfinished, grew distant, then faded from view. The figure of Emmanuel, who didn't resemble you in the slightest, grew distant, then faded from view. The white peaks that did resemble Pekgunde and Insubong grew distant, and eventually, when the boat slipped around a gorge, passed out of view. Why was I struck by a chill just then? Why does it come back to me so vividly, even now? That scene which seemed to tell of a very slow parting. That silence which seemed filled with countless words. As though I were being offered some kind of answer. As though an answer, one that was acutely painful and also a blessing, had already been given to me, and it was up to me to make sense of it. Radiant, hazily bright, shaded. I spend 3 days gazing at the ceiling without my glasses, sensing the minute differences in light intensity that these few expressions cannot render. It's beyond comprehension. You died, and I feel as though everything has fallen away from me. You died. That is all. And it is as though every single one of my memories is rapidly bleeding, staining, rusting, deteriorating. "The way you do philosophy is too literary," you'd admonish me now and then. "Isn't the place you're trying to arrive at through contemplation simply a kind of literary nirvana?" I remember the debates we used to have into the late hours, and how, when we were finally done and turned our attention back to the blank wall or the dark curtain, a clean silence would meet us, as if it had been waiting all the while. In those days, you simply couldn't be beaten. Every question I posed, you would untangle lucidly, whereas your questions always made me lose my way. "Wrong," you would say. "I'm sorry, but what you just said is wrong." As a long discussion was winding down, you'd add, "I do think you're best suited to literature." You were a strict friend in that way, an incredibly exacting teacher, though we were of the same age. I assumed the teacher's advice was probably correct, but I wasn't able to follow it. I couldn't stand the hours I had to spend reading literary texts. I had no desire to put my trust in a world of wobbly, laxly interlaced sensory perceptions and images, emotions and thoughts. And yet, I couldn't help but become captivated by the things of that world. When teacher Borchardt explained Aristotle's concept of potentiality, dynamis, "My hair will gray in the future, but that is not present reality. Just as it isn't snowing now, but when winter comes, it will snow at least once." What moved me, simply, was the beautiful melding of those two images. I cannot forget the vision I had then of all our hair, young students and tall teachers alike, turning to frost as snow whirled all around us. It was the same when I read Plato's late works and was entranced by the question of whether mud, hair, heat haze, shadows reflected in water, fleeting gestures, have form. Simply because that wondering was sensually beautiful and touched the electrode inside me that responds to beauty. I remember the theme that was occupying me in those days. The lengthy, futile, forlorn conversations you and I had until the dead of night about the forms of darkness, death, dissolution. You stated that all forms are beauty and virtue and the sublime. You said this in a calm, sad way, as though you were patiently persuading a younger student. It simply can't be otherwise, can it? Which is why it has to follow that all forms are necessarily related to the form of goodness. Do you see? Just as the open plazas of Seoul, Venice, Frankfurt, and Mainz all exist on the same day. Shaking my head, I said, "But what if, supposing there were a form of dissolution? Surely it would be a clean, virtuous, sublime dissolution. That is to say, wouldn't the form of dissolving sleet be sleet that disappears without a trace, cleanly, beautifully, completely?" You shook your head. "Look at it like this. Death and dissolution are contrary to forms from the outset. Sleet that melts into mud cannot ever have had a form." At your words, the whole ephemeral world lost its color. "But the world of sleet that scatters in all directions, eternally unmelting, eternally not settling on the ground, remains spread out before me still like a dark vision." "Look at it like this," you said again, as though trying to appease me. "In darkness, there are no forms. There is only darkness, a minus darkness. To put it simply, there are no forms in the sub-zero world. There has to be light, no matter however faint. Without even a feeble light, there is no form. Don't you get it? It doesn't matter how negligible the beauty, the sublime, but somehow or other, there has to be a plus light, forms of death and dissolution." You may as well be talking of round triangles. That same night, you suddenly asked me, without fear as always, boldly risking the hurt it might cause me, how much of an influence my impending blindness had on my everyday thoughts and feelings. I stared at your face without answering, at the shadows suspended under your eyes, your sunken cheeks, your dark, dead lips. How should I have answered those hateful words? Your cruel question. I hadn't considered myself through such a stark frame before that day. I'd moved to Germany too late in my teens to have complete command of the German language. However hard I tried, the only subjects where I was able to outstrip my peers were maths and ancient Greek. It's not unusual for East Asian kids to be good at maths, but ancient Greek is different. Even my friends who did pretty well at Latin threw up their hands when it came to Greek grammar. its complicated grammatical system, and the fact that it was a long-dead language, meant Greek felt to me like a safe, quiet room. As I passed more and more time in that room, I became known as the East Asian kid who was surprisingly good at Greek. And it was around then that I began to be drawn to Plato's works, as though by a magnetic force. But was that really how it was? Might it actually have been for the reason you gave that I was drawn to Plato's back-to-front world? Just as, before that, I had been spellbound by Buddhism, which did away with the real world of sensory existence in one fell swoop? That is to say, because I was certain to lose this visible world? That early dawn, why couldn't I have thrown the same question back at you? Why couldn't I have been brave like you, risked hurting you in the same bold, impertinent way by retorting, "If those are my present circumstances, what influence do your circumstances have on your thoughts and actions?" During those long hours that I spent with you, the words I actually desperately wanted to say, more than any other question and answer, more than any quote or allusion or argument, may have been these: that when the most frail, tender, forlorn parts of us, that is to say, our life breaths, are at some point returned to the world of matter, we will receive nothing in recompense. That when the time comes for me, I don't see myself remembering the full range of the experiences I'd accumulated up to that point only in terms of beauty. That it is in this tired, worn context that I understand Plato. That he himself knew that such beauty does not exist. And that there is no complete thing, ever, at least in this world. Sometimes, I'll recall dream images from that time in my life with unusual clarity. Snowflakes that melt as soon as they touch late autumn's still warm earth. The vertiginous unfurling of heat haze in early springtime. Their faint, muffled presence. Fragments of a god I never believed in. Form that is neither born nor extinguished. The Huayam I'd clung to with all I had at 15, which rises behind all beings like dazzling shadows over water and blooms forth as thousands of brilliant flowers that encompass the world. I lie here, staring up into the vague whiteness of the emptiness above me, thinking about that world. I peer at it with eyes wide open. Whereas the things that captivated you then were altogether different. Physical reality and time. The world that was born in a heated explosion out of nothingness. Time's seed in eternal suspension prior to its unfurling. Yes, time. What Borges called a fire that consumes him. You wanted to touch that riddle with your bare hands. The arrow loosed in a moment that flies forever. The life that, caught within it, stands blazing in the face of extinction. Eventually, unable to endure your studies, you made your escape. You swore to me, to your exhausted mother, that you would never be a student again. I remember your friends, the piercings in their lips, noses, tongues, and the one friend among them who had unusually sad eyes. I remember their sorrowful music, how it tore at the heart the louder they played it. You said to me, "No one can understand me unless they also grew up within the benzene smell of hospital wards." You said, "Beauty is only that which is intense, has a vibrant energy." You said, "This thing we call life mustn't ever become something endured." You said, "Dreaming of another world than this is a sin." And so to you, beauty was the thronging streets, the tram that stops brimming with simmering sunshine, the furiously racing heart, the swelling lungs, the still warm lips, and the fervent rubbing of those lips against another's. Have you lost all that fire? Can you really be dead? Your face immersed in thought, the deep creases around your mouth, your eyes wreathed in smiles, the way you'd shrug when you didn't want to give an obvious answer. The first time you embraced me, when I felt the ardent, unconcealable desire suffusing that gesture, I realized something with spine-tingling clarity. The sadness of the human body. The human body with its many indented, tender, vulnerable parts. The forearms, the armpits, the chest, the groin. A body born to embrace someone, to desire to embrace someone. I should have embraced you as hard as I could, at least once before that period of our lives passed us by. It wouldn't have hurt or harmed me to do so. I would have withstood it, survived it. Soon, I will be unable to distinguish my own reflection from other objects. All the faces I remember will become fixed, firm, and unchanging, in my memory as in ice. If you were here, you would advise me without hesitation. You would shrug your shoulders, screw up your nose exaggeratedly, and say, "What's the big deal? Learn Braille, write poetry by boring holes into white paper, become friends with a golden retriever." If you hadn't died, would I have touched your face when I saw you again in Germany? Would I have read your forehead, your eyelids, the ridge of your nose, the creases of your cheeks and jaw with my hands? No. I wouldn't have been able to. The more time that passed, the more you desired me. You struggled, unable to endure that desire. You tore down with your own hands everything that was between us. I fled far and fast, wounding you deeply. I resented you. I couldn't sleep for longing to see the you who was not you. I yearned like madness only for the you who was not you. Is that lonely body now dead? Did your body sometimes remember me? Right at this moment, my body remembers yours. That brief, agonizing embrace. Your trembling hands and mildly warm face. The tears gathered in your eyes.
Chapter 15. She leans forward, tightens her grip on the pencil, lowers her head further. The words evade her grasp. Words that have lost lips. Words that have lost tongue and tooth root. Words that have lost throat and breath remain out of reach. Like unbodied apparitions, their forms elude touch. Chapter 16. Epichoni aner keterepe kion epitei vearei kripos epitoi rlefaroi usti horan autoi aner epeste usti akuen. A person lies prone in the snow. Snow in their throat. Earth in their eyes. Seeing nothing. A person stands next to them. Hearing nothing. Chapter 17. Darkness. A bird has just flown into the building. A titmouse, smaller than a young child's fist. It starts to bump its head against the concrete wall and against the railing of the stairs that lead up to the first floor, crying urgently, as if, having just flown in, it nonetheless cannot find the way out. The woman steps in through the entrance and quietly stops in her tracks. She watches as the bird strikes its head against the wall once again. Then she turns back. Opens the closed half of the double glass door. Says from a place deeper than throat and tongue, "Come on out now." To encourage the bird, she gently thumps her back against the wall. The bird clearly takes this as a threat. It flies straight down into the darkness of the stairs that lead to the basement, hides itself under the railing, and doesn't budge. "You can't hide there. Come on out now." She draws back two steps and hears a frail chirping.
"Bee, bee."
As though the bird has lowered its guard. She takes a step forward, and the sound abruptly stops. She looks out of the open doors. Some are trees, their trunks touched with white, are steeped in the evening glow. A taxi with its fog lights on pulls up in front of the glass doors. The man gets out of the taxi. He is wearing a plain white cotton shirt and dark gray cotton trousers. In order not to trip on the dark steps leading up to the entrance, as soon as he gets out of the taxi, he switches on a small flashlight. He turns it off upon entering the building's illuminated interior, adjusts the shoulder strap of his heavy-looking bag, and walks over to the woman. He hesitates, then asks in a low voice,
"What are you looking at?"
The man leans forward, toward the black living thing beneath the stair railing that the woman is peering at. It moves slightly in the darkness. He switches on his flashlight and shines it in that direction. Is it a rat? A kitten? He can't make it out. What he can make out is the tension in the woman's breathing. He realizes that this is the first time he has heard her make any kind of sound. She has her hair tied tightly back. The stray strands below her ears quiver in time with her inhales and exhales. The man wishes he could see her properly. The overhead lights are not bright enough for him to make out the expression on the woman's face, and he can't very well shine the flashlight at her. As he wonders whether he should try to sign to her again, the sound of the woman's breathing grows distant. The black short-sleeved blouse and black trousers, the glimpsed face, neck, and arms grow distant. The sound of low-heeled shoes rings out distinctly on the stone stairs, like punctuation marks. The man stands and strains to listen to that sound, which continues without a pause all the way to the second floor corridor. Listening to the footsteps pull wordlessly, endlessly away. He wonders what feelings they are stirring up in him. Wonders when it was he had felt this conflicted. The man takes a step to follow the woman, but stops when he hears a bee, bee sound. He looks toward the bottom of the stairs, and the black object that had been lying motionless hops two, three steps up from the basement. He shines the flashlight at it, but it curls up again and becomes deathly still. Only then does he guess that it is a bird.
"Come out. You shouldn't be here."
His voice echoes in the dark corridor. He turns his head and looks at the trees outside the front entrance. The evening is rapidly deepening, and the outlines of trunks and limbs appear almost black. He hesitates, then opens his bag and pulls out a thick textbook. He rolls it up and holds it in one hand. Then, shining the flashlight with the other hand, cautiously descends the stairs. He isn't planning to go down more than three steps. The bird still doesn't move an inch. He stoops to usher the bird in the right direction with a book, but the bird flaps up at him all of a sudden, chirping sharply. Trying to avoid the bird flying at his face, he loses his footing on the stairs, drops the flashlight. The bird bangs its head against the wall. The railing. It flies at him again. His glasses fall off. Hearing a fluttering sound just behind his ear, he wraps his arms around his face and staggers. Twice, three times, he steps on his glasses, cracking the lenses. Shunted underfoot, they tumble down to the bottom of the stairs. Flapping its wings with all its strength, the The bird darts toward the glass doors, dashes its head against the concrete wall, the tin mailboxes. He is sitting on the dark stairs. Everything is black, mauled. He gropes the stairs with trembling hands, searching for his glasses. Far below him, how far he cannot judge, the flashlight lies in a foggy halo of light.
Is anyone there?
His voice is hoarse and doesn't come out well.
Is anyone there?
He brings his wristwatch right up to his eyes and squints at the yellow-green luminous hands. He can hardly make them out. Probably around 8:15. It is the final week in July, the Thursday before the peak of the summer holiday. Friday's class has been canceled, and the part-time admin said she would leave the classroom door open and take off early for her hometown. The middle-aged man with a 9-to-6 job had let him know in advance that he would be absent today, which meant that only the woman, the postgrad, and the philosophy student would be there right now, in the second floor classroom. The woman is someone who cannot help him. The other two are the types to wait patiently for a good half hour for the lecturer to appear, chatting about this and that. He begins to feel his way over the stairs with both hands. When he has felt all along one step, he lowers himself down to the next, still in a seated position. Luckily, his fingers find his bag not far away. Opening the front zip and fumbling around inside, he discovers that he has forgotten his mobile. This afternoon, a letter he'd sent to Germany a month ago had been returned, and, though he'd only briefly become distracted as he placed it on his desk and let his thoughts wander, it had still made him late. He can't recall having collected his phone as he rushed out of the door after only a quick shave. After fixing the bag diagonally across his chest so that it wouldn't fall off again, he recommences groping the stairs. He can feel only dirt and dust and small hard fragments of things he cannot identify. Whenever he comes across a few sharp fragments, he gives that area a thorough going over. But he can't be sure if it's glass from his lenses. On his hands and bottom, he lowers himself toward the center of what seems like a diffuse pool of light deep under the sea. Before anything else, he needs to get his hands on that flashlight. As his palms scrape over the stair, he groans. He has found his glasses. They are completely broken. At the sharp, warm sensation of blood flowing from the fingertips of his right hand, he bites down on the inside of his lower lip. He fumbles his uninjured left hand over every inch of the bent frames, the now empty spaces where the lenses have shattered. How much time has gone by? He hears no sign of anyone. Whether it has long flown out the doors or died from battering its head, even the bird is silent. On such a still evening as this, wouldn't he be able to hear, even faintly, the two male students talking, especially the postgrad's loud, resonant voice? If they haven't shown up, that means the only person in the second floor classroom is the woman. He thinks of her sitting silently in the empty classroom and shuts his eyes tightly. The puddle of light disappears, but the darkness that flickers and wavers behind his eyelids is almost the same as when he had his eyes open. He cannot call out to the woman for help. The woman cannot hear. Eventually, he opens his eyes. He runs his left hand over the next stair down, preparing to lower himself further toward the pooled light. Just then, he hears footsteps ring out in the corridor of the floor above. Making an effort to keep his hands away from the broken glass this time, he begins to falter his way upward on hands and knees. He's certain. It's the same footsteps as before. He pounds the metal railing with his fist, swings his heavy bag against it over and over again. If she cannot hear,
Perhaps she will sense these vibrations.
Help me!
He shouts, even as he's convinced it's useless. Eventually, the sound of footsteps draws toward the basement stairs. He is unable to identify the moving darkness, the darkness that overlies the darkness. All he can sense is that the footsteps have stopped somewhere close by, that there is a faint sound of someone breathing, that the person is approaching. He opens his eyes as wide as he can and looks toward the direction of the sound.
Can you hear me? Is there no one else upstairs? My glasses are broken. My sight is very bad. Would you call someone? I need to get a taxi before the optician's closes. Can you hear me?
A faint apple scent reaches his nose. Two cold, agile hands slide under his armpits. Those hands guide him to his feet. He struggles to tread securely over the floor he cannot see. Leaning on the arms of a person he cannot see, he climbs the stairs one step at a time. Each time he loses his footing, the arms supporting him regain their strength. The luminosity of the darkness is changing. Now he can discern that the stairs have ended, and that they are approaching the front entrance, where the lights are on. The contours of things reappear, dim and black. The gray that he guesses are the mailboxes, the white section of wall, the overwhelming darkness that must be what lies outside the double doors. The woman has one arm across his back. Her other hand supports his wrist. The humid breeze hits him. They are standing in front of the wide-open glass doors. The vague outline of the woman's face and arm is dimly guessed at. He carelessly wipes his bleeding hand on his shirt. The smashed, warped glasses he's been clutching all this time fall to his feet. Are the red splotches continuously materializing down there? His blood? He bends to pick up his glasses. He cannot reach them. Moistening his dry lips with the tip of his tongue, he says to the woman, "My wallet is in my bag. There's enough for the taxi fare. If we go downtown, we'll be able to find an optician's. I need new glasses."